You are about to listen to Web Sleuths Radio, a true crime podcast where the opinions expressed on this show are those of my guests, or if they happen to be my own opinions, which I could change at any minute, any day, of any month. Now, enjoy the show. Welcome, my darling true crime angels, to another edition of Web Sleuths Radio. Some people have even suggested that Web Sleuths Radio is finger-licking good. I believe it. Hey, it's been a wild week, true crime-wise. On Web Sleuths, the big hot topics, well, the horrible, tragic topics, the school shootings, two of them in 1 week. We'll be discussing those. But the biggest topic on Web Sleuths right now, the Turpin case. The couple in California that tortured their 12 out of 13 children, apparently the little baby, was left alone, unless, of course, you count the lewdness against a child charge, which could be against the child. We don't know. David and Louise Turpin, very, very twisted people. And to help us untwist their minds, let's welcome back FBI former profiler Pete Klismet. Now, Pete has written two books so far, FBI Diary, Profiles of Evil, and FBI Diary, Homegrown Terror. He now is on the speaker circuit. He continues to write books, and he joins us on Web Sleuths Radio to try and figure all of this out. Now, Pete, David and Louise Turpin, they have pled not guilty to charges of torture, child abuse, and false imprisonment. Now, Pete Klismet, you've only read what we have read. You don't have any inside scoop, but I think you can get into their mind better than anybody. What in the world would make two people keep some of their children in chains, make them sit in their own excrement day in and day out, starve them, torture them with food, keep them from the outside world? What would make former FBI profiler Pete Klismet, these people, do this? Get in their mind for us.
As you were saying that, it just gave me a chill, believe it or not, you know, despite the fact that I spent the greater part of my life, two-thirds of it, in law enforcement, it's still, when you run into cases like this, and this one is unprecedented, there have been a number of cases over the years where parents would, say, lock a child into a closet and completely deprive them of any sensory input, feed them but a minimal amount of food. But this is, I've never heard of anything like this, quite frankly, and that's because there probably hasn't been anything like this. You're right, I appreciate you understanding that. I have read these accounts because a lot of people think, well, because of who you are, then you've got inside information. You know, you can contact them and find stuff out. Well, no, who I are is simply, I'm just a normal person. I'm retired. And so I don't have any law enforcement authority whatsoever. So I'm like you. I mean, I can't call the police force and say, hey, give me some stuff. So I read this stuff, and if it's unusual enough, then I'll read it pretty thoroughly. I mean, I'll read it pretty thoroughly anyhow, but I tend to look at it in a different way as I'm reading it. Here's some of the things I notice that probably a lot of people wouldn't. Number one, she was 16 and he was 23 when they married. That is, for that age, that is a huge difference. It's a significant difference because, you know, what it tells me is that he is, at 23, able to impress her with his life experiences, which probably were minimal. But nonetheless, able to impress her with that type of thing. Okay, so the other thing I noticed, and others may have noticed this, that he's a lot taller than her, probably a foot taller. The guy really looks tall. And so that enables him to not only mentally probably, but physically dominate her simply by size and strength. Now, that is a trend that she's going to fall into, and it'll continue, and probably will continue, become a routine for their entire life.
Part of it is the physical domination. However, we do know that Louise grew up in a very dysfunctional household. Her sister Elizabeth claims she was raped, so we can assume that Louise had just as a horrific childhood as her sister Elizabeth. So let me just sit here in my armchair psychologist chair and make a few observations, please. David Turpin got Louise when she was very young. She was 16, he was what, 23, 24? Big age difference, especially that time in your life. 16 to 23, 24, that's huge. So he picked on someone that he knew he could control, but also somebody that was very damaged. People like David Turpin, and I know you haven't spoken with him, you just know what we know, but we're asking you to base this on your knowledge. People like David Turpin are downright predators, right?
Yeah, in a sense, they are. And what you said is very accurate, that this enables them to control someone else. And that's, you know, that's particularly interesting because what if they need control over someone else, what I've found over the years is that tells me someone else controlled them. So they, and that's usually by abuse, whether verbal or whether it's physical abuse, psychological abuse. And so somebody controlled them is what is usually the case. And they never had the opportunity to have that control themselves. So now, with him being 23, her being 16, and her being very vulnerable, as you say, she was sexually assaulted, then that enables him to gain and to maintain that control over his, over her ad infinitum.
Based on your experience, what do you think David Turpin was thinking when he pled not guilty to all of these charges? Is he really trying to rationalize that somehow what he did was okay to do because he was the dad? Or do you think he's thinking, oh no, I'm in big trouble. I'm just going to plead not guilty and then see what happens. What do you think?
Well, I don't know about that, but you mentioned him having pled guilty. And I remember years ago when...
I meant to say he pled not guilty. Sorry. Not guilty.
Yeah, that was me that said guilty. And I remember years ago, and this applies here in a sense by analogy, when the O.J. Simpson case happened, and I was back in Colorado from California or somewhere, and was talking to my mom, and mom asked me, well, Pete, why didn't he just go to court and plead guilty? Well, the answer to that is very easy, because when you plead not guilty, that doesn't mean I didn't commit the crime, because probably 95% of the people wind up guilty eventually. In his initial appearance in court, he stood up in court represented by an attorney I know personally out in California, Howard Weinstein, and entered a plea of not guilty to both charges. What that does is it begins the process of discovery and of the prosecution showing the defense what evidence they've got to prove their case. And so that's the same thing with these people. They plead not guilty. That doesn't mean they didn't do it, because it's obvious they did do it. Just like it was obvious that O.J. did it, but some people just didn't quite figure that out. But these Turpin folks will now have the opportunity to exercise their rights, which we are all granted by the Constitution under the particularly the 4th, 5th, and 6th Amendment. They don't have to make statements. They have rights to a speedy trial, I guess I'd say, under the 6th. So anyhow, it gives them the opportunity to exercise their rights. And then down the line, once all the evidence is presented against them, perhaps in a, well, out in California, in all likelihood, there will be a preliminary hearing. But there may be a grand jury indictment, too. And so they're just going through the process right now.
I asked former FBI profiler Pete Klizmet, what do you think might happen if the authorities can separate the monsters, Louise being a monster and David being a monster. What if they were able to separate Louise, kind of she's maybe the weaker one in the herd, and maybe they could flip her and get her to testify against David? Possible? Maybe?
I think there is a chance of that, but I would probably say from all those accumulated years, it's been they've been married for, 30-some years, 32 years, I think, that there has been enough fear that has built up over those years that there's a possibility she may say drop dead when they say, you know, we want to talk to you. And they'll definitely talk to her first. Whether or not she'll talk to them is a completely different matter. I'm inclined to think they will. She will. And when that happens, then she's going to be the fulcrum of the entire case, the critical link that would be able to, you know, provide all the evidence. But we also have to think about the kids. You know, we got one 29-year-old in this. When I read this, I could barely believe this. I mean, we've got 29-year-old that's been held hostage essentially for entire life, it sounds like. But,
exactly.
You know, their testimony, assuming they are articulate enough to testify and willing to testify against their father and perhaps their mother, will make a great difference in what happens with the case, too.
It's my understanding, as of right now, the older children will be going to a group home. Younger children will go to foster care. Hopefully they can keep them all together, but it's kind of a large group of kids, but we can keep our fingers crossed. I can't imagine the type of damage that has happened to all of these children, and not just the Turpin kids, but all the kids that suffer this horrible abuse. And Pete Glismet, former FBI profiler, I know you have seen some pretty bad cases. Can you comment on some of those and maybe give us your opinion on how the kids are going to handle this? What's going to happen to them?
Well, right off the bat, I mean, dealing with as many killers and even several serial killers as I have over the years, we've had people that were, you know, greatly influenced by their parents in the same manner. But in the case of these kids, I don't know how a 28-year-old or 29-year-old who has reached that age and yet has been held hostage all of that time can have any social adequacy. I mean, I just wouldn't imagine that they could. Secondly, do they have the educational capabilities, you know, to perform or to understand or to read and write, for heaven's sakes, you know, even spell? And then thirdly, would be what kind of relationships would they ultimately be able to form themselves? And you asked the question, what effect would it have on them? Well, it's certainly going to have a long-term effect psychologically. That doesn't take anybody with a degree in rocket science to figure out. But in something I read just within the last few days, a psychologist, psychiatrist said that with the deprivation of food, then that's going to have a physical effect on their brain. And a lot of those nutrition the brain should have been getting, it didn't get. And as a consequence, there are going to be some undeveloped and undevelopable areas of the brain that aren't going to work properly. So there will be a long-term effect on them for the entirety of their life, except for the very young ones. And they could probably, as I think and as I've read, probably be able to pull them out of that.
One of the oddest stories I've heard so far is supposedly one of the older children was allowed to go to community college. Mom would drop him off and be right there after school to pick him up, no socializing, and obviously that ended at some point. Don't you find that strange?
But yes, that is very odd. And then a lot of people, I would say probably 75 to 90% of the people in this country would say, well, if he's gone to school, then he's in classroom and he's independent. Why didn't he just walk out the back door and go running up the hill and go talk to the police? Well, there's something called the Stockholm Syndrome, which was identified, I'm going to say, 40 years ago, where if a person is held hostage, then they become very dependent on the person that's holding them for their life, for everything, all that can be provided. And so, and then there's also fear. If they were to run away, and then they would think, well, maybe I'll be caught, and then what will my dad put me through, or mom, when I get caught? So that's not terribly unusual for a kidnapping victim, or even a more short-term type thing, like a bank robber holds bank employees hostage inside the bank. And that's exactly where the Stockholm syndrome evolved from.
We've all heard of the Stockholm syndrome, but it's a really weird story how that came about.
Well, there was a bank in Stockholm, and I don't know, 6 or 8 years ago, my wife and I were over there. I specifically made a point of having our driver that was turning us around go to that bank, because I wanted to see that bank, take pictures of it, and then I would have it for classes I was teaching college at the time, and did. But anyhow, let me digress, or let me get started on what happened. These bank robbers, I believe there was two of them, went into this bank, and they had all of the employees, and they held them hostage inside. Police arrived, so now they've got them barricaded inside. And so they negotiated back and forth for quite a period of time. But one of the females that was inside the bank, one of the employees, I guess essentially fell in love with one of the suspects. Ultimately, believe this or not, wound up marrying him after he went to prison. But in any event, they kept wondering. They would try to negotiate. She would answer the phone, and she would argue and fight with the police over the telephone. And so she had made the turn over, I guess, to their side, to the bad guy's side. And she was on their side. She was part of the team. So, a lot, you know, there's some very strong, utterly strange psychological things that could happen to somebody who does not have a real strong personality. That would never happen to someone like myself. I would constantly be finding, you're trying to find a way to get out of there. There's quite a number of people that I know that could fall into that category, you know, that they would be part of the team, essentially.
Now we're going to change the subject completely. We're going to talk about something that I believe everybody on Web Sleuths is interested in. That would be serial killers. Now, granted, we all wish serial killers were gone. Never happened, and we never heard of a serial killer. But unfortunately, that's not the case. Serial killers are being created every single day. So I asked Pete Klismet, remember he is a retired FBI profiler, I asked him what the definition of a serial killer is, and how did they get started? What happened to turn them into a serial killer?
Okay, well, let's take that apart. The first part was, what is the definition of a serial killer? Now, interestingly enough, when I was one of the original profilers that went through the training in 1984, the definition of a serial killer was somebody that killed three or more people over a period of time with a cooling off period in between the killings. There was a symposium held, which I didn't go to, in 2005. I'd been retired for a while. In San Antonio, Texas, and somehow they managed to change the definition of serial killer to somebody that kills two or more people, but two would then qualify somebody as a serial killer. And with the cooling off period in between. I hate that definition. I don't like it. In fact, I just finished the first edition of a manuscript on a book that's going to be used for colleges and universities. And I talk about that in the book, that just doesn't fit my definition, the two. Because what that does is elevate us from having about 400 serial killers that we could count over the years to about 1,800 serial killers. And, you know, if somebody kills two people, I would think ordinarily they're going to stop. If they've killed three or more people, they are not going to stop. That's the definition now, that, you know, somebody kills two or more over a period of time. Well, we can't really, I mean, that's an unanswerable question because it happens in a variety of different ways. It may happen with a very physically or verbally or both abusive parent or parents in the family. Could possibly happen to any of these kids, or the kids we were talking about, the Turpins. It will happen in manners that we just don't understand. For instance, take Jeffrey Dahmer. Everybody's heard of Jeff Dahmer. Mm-hmm. One of the most notorious serial killers in the history of the United States, killed 17 young men, homosexual men. And his family was as ordinary, perhaps better than most families that most of us grow up in. His dad was a PhD chemistry professor at, I believe it was Ohio State or some other university back in Ohio. His mother, I mean, they had a somewhat normal family life, apparently. They ultimately did get married, but I think this was after, I don't remember when it was, quite frankly, I can't say, but they did get divorced. I think I said remarried. I don't know where that came from. But is that unusual? No, because that happens to over two-thirds of the marriages in this country anyhow. So Dahmer grew up in a manner that was not dissimilar to a manner that many of us grew up in. Now, years ago, when I was in college, I can remember sitting in my criminology class, and our professor, Tom Johnson, PhD, Michigan State, was talking about the different ways that people become killers. And one of the ways he proposed is that they were born that way. Mm-hmm. Well, I think most everybody, including myself, in the classroom, either said or thought, that's the stupidest thing that I've ever heard in my life. As time progressed up until the present, that'd be almost 50 years ago, mm-hmm. For me, then my thinking on that has turned around, not 100%, but it's turned around quite a bit. Why? Because of the advent of DNA testing, what we're learning about the brain, and how the brain operates, we still don't know. But in any event, I think there is evidence to show that some traits concerning violence may be passed along from one generation to another, certainly, but even there's... Maybe there's a gene up the food chain from great-great-great-grandpa. And this can be proven very easily by saying that mental illness is something. Schizophrenia is something that's passed on. It's a genetic trait. We're talking about nature versus nurture, and that has gone on for many years. This is a nature thing that they were born that way. They were born, as was an old guy in California, Herbert Mullen, mm-hmm. were born to be serial killers because they were born and they inherited mental illness, paranoid schizophrenia at the time. So, you know, go from there. In the book that I just finished, the textbook, that's one of the things at the outset that I spent some time talking about to debunk or demystify some of the thoughts about serial killers. And like you said, they didn't wake up one morning, have some coffee, read the paper, check their emails, and then all of a sudden, oh, well, okay, new occupation, I'm going to be a serial killer, and then run around and start killing people.
Mm-hmm.
This happens over a pretty extended period of time. And there's so many things involved in this that you and I don't have enough time to even begin to get into it.
When I asked Peter Klizmet, is it possible that a serial killer is born, they have something in their makeup, in their DNA, something in there that if it kicks in for whatever reason, they become a serial killer. I've heard that a lot of people are born with whatever this is, and then if they have something traumatic happen in their childhood, boom, they're a serial killer. And I asked him, I said, am I just babbling like a fool as usual, or am I right? And he laughs at me.
Well, frankly, I've never heard that.
Babbling as a fool like normal. Okay.
Yeah, I've proposed many of my own theories. I'm going to have a meeting with myself about that, because that is actually a very good thought, and a thought that I've never had. That's so good for you.
Well, I told him when he had that meeting with himself to get back with me, and we'll discuss what himself found out, if that makes any sense. Unfortunately, we have to go to a very, very serious topic, and that is school shootings. What in the hell are we going to do? What causes kids to go to school and kill?
You know, I've been asking that same question for many years. People have done research on it. I happen to be one of those people that have done research on it. And in fact, probably will have a book of some sort on what I have found out, because I've looked at it in the way that most people don't. But there's two types of school shootings. There are internal shootings where one of the students, perhaps, or even one of the faculty, or maybe somebody on the cleaning staff, that's happened, internal to the school, do the shooting and cause that. Then there's the external, where this has happened quite a number of times, like this Looney Tunes guy, Adam Lanza,
right,
in Connecticut at Sandy Hook, shot 26 people at the school and killed, well, shot more than that, but killed 26 kids. You cannot compare shootings at schools below high school or high school or below with shootings at colleges, such as at Virginia Tech X number of years ago. Very different situations. Because, well, that one involved mental health. That
right.
Chin Hung So or whatever his name was.
Right, yeah.
He was clearly mentally deficient. And as was, I think, Adam Lanza. We never were able to find that out for sure, but if you look at his picture, it doesn't take a Phi Beta Kappa to figure that out.
Yeah.
Very different types of occurrences.
Talking about the high school and middle school kids and the shootings, help. What? Why?
Yeah, me too. I'm right along with you. We're in the same boat. Help.
Okay, obviously these kids are full of anger, but when you see some of the shooter's parents, your heart breaks for them too. The worst thing in the world would be to have your child murdered. The second worst thing in the world would be if your child murdered somebody. Now, as someone who has studied criminals, I asked Mr. Klizmet to tell us, even if he has to guess, what his best guess is as to what is going on with these kids.
Well, you said there has to be anger. When you said that, that kind of raised a red flag for me because, again, we could break them down into two groups that I mentioned, the internal and the external. But then we can break that down a little bit further that maybe they're targeting particular people. Now, that was the one in Texas, I believe, where the guy was upset about his girlfriend breaking up with him, and so he shot her and her current boyfriend, as I recall. And then, so we could have that as a focus, and that would be, what, jealousy or revenge, whatever we want to call it. But I can't say it would be anger that is built up over quite a period of time. That would be more short-term. Then there's general anger that has built up. Let's say Columbine. These two guys, Klebold and Harris, had felt like they were, as the English say it, hard done by. And, in fact, probably were. You know, they were kind of oddballs, and they were picked on a bit by some of the members of the football teams.
Right.
Popular kids in school. They weren't. They were on the outside. They were the mafia of some stripe. And so they were clearly the outsiders. They fit the, I mean, there is a bit of a profile for these types of kids that will do it. And so they have general anger that, in my mind, they have built that anger up for quite a long period of time. So that is analogous to, it's not terribly different from some of the shooters that we have in the workplace. So now we're dealing with a similar type of situation where you got general anger and rage eventually sets it off.
In closing, former FBI profiler Pete Klismet, with two books on Amazon, FBI Diary Profiles of Evil and FBI Diary Homegrown Terror, what would you like to say in closing in general about what's going on in the United States and as a profiler looking at people's behavior today? Do you have any comments?
We are one of, and in fact, one of the top three violent countries in the entire world, percentage-wise, of killings of people. In, you know, out of 100,000 people, how likely is it to be killed? And I think in the United States, there's about 13 of 100,000 that are killed. Brazil is worse than us, and then there's another country down in South America, and I said I thought it was Paraguay, but I'm not positive. No, it's Colombia, now that I think of it. And then we're right there on the list. We're in the top five. So what does that mean? Well, what it means is I've given lots of talks, and I've asked the question to the audience, how many murders do you think we have in the United States every year? And somebody would say, well, 100. And somebody else might say, as they did, well, probably about 1 million. Well, both of those are woefully low or high. We have about 15 to 16,000 murders in the United States every year. And for, you know, I mean, I'm not going to tout or I'm not going to badmouth the gun lobby, but about 12,000 of those 15, 16,000 are committed with a firearm of some sort. I'll just let that sit. That's a statistic that I know, and somebody could argue, you know, the old standard argument is guns don't kill people, people kill people. Okay. How many times have we heard that? I mean, enough to bluff, you know, several times. What are we going to do? I don't know what we're going to do. I really wish I knew. Believe it or not, our murder rate has gone down considerably in the United States because back in 1987 or thereabouts, about 30 years ago, we had in that era 24 to 25,000 murders every year, and our population was much lower. So we were at the top of the food chain in the entire world at that. Well, it's probably not a good way to put it, but, you know, we were the highest country in the entire world. Now, let me add something to this. My wife and I were over in England a number of years ago in London, and I was talking with a couple of people that were police officers. They found out that I was, you know, a former FBI agent, and they were very excited about that, so we all, you know, got to talk a little bit. And I asked them, you know, about firearms. Police there were not allowed to carry firearms for many, many years. Well, why was that? Well, in large part because firearms were outlawed except for things like hunting in England, in the entire country. They're outlawed. Mm-hmm. England, I asked, has how many murders every year? And they said, oh, maybe 80, maybe 100. Wait a minute. Did you say 80 or 100? Are there any other zeros after that? That was it. For a country that's got a population one-fifth the size of ours. So, is firearms, you know, are they a factor? There's no doubt in my mind they are, but would I say that to a group of firearms fans? Probably not, because I'd probably get stoned off the stage.
And we'll leave it at that. Pete Klizmet, former FBI profiler, thank you for joining us again on Web Sleuths Radio. Don't worry, we will have you back over and over and over. We always kind of lasso our guests and hold on to them for life. That's all there is to it. They have no choice. There is a new show coming out on ID. It will come out in February. It's called Love and Hate. The first episode of Love and Hate is so shocking. It's the story of Josh Vallum and his girlfriend Mercedes Williamson, who is really Michael. There are so many twists and turns in this story, you won't believe it. But first, before we get to the director, Ben Steele, and tell you the story of Josh and Mercedes, I need to tell you a story. This is a true story. I knew a guy, was a great guy. His name was Doug Kohler, spelled just like the plumbing fixtures, but no relation, he used to say. He was a tall guy, he was big, but he wasn't fat. Now, he gave himself the nickname Big Dumb Doug, and it fit. This guy was hilarious and loving. Oh, God, when he'd hug you, you felt like you were so safe in his big, strong arms. He was adorable. One night, Big Dumb Doug and a bunch of my radio friends went out club hopping in Park City. Now, I lived in Park City at the time, and I was invited to go, but I said, nah, I'm too old. I'm an old bat. I was an old bat. This was 1993. I was old back then. I was done partying. The next morning, my phone rang. As soon as I said hello, my friend said, Big Dumb Doug was murdered last night. Here's what happened. Basically, Doug separated from the rest of the crowd and went to a gay bar in Park City. He met up with some guy and they went back to his place, to the guy's place. And apparently there were friends of his hanging around. Well, this guy and Big Dumb Doug, they go in the bedroom and they come out. And Big Dumb Doug says, goodbye, everybody. And he starts to walk back to his condo that they had rented for the weekend. Well, here's the deal. David Nelson Thacker, that's the killer's name. David Nelson Thacker was an ignorant redneck bastard, and so were his friends, because they figured out what went on in that bedroom, and they started to harass David Nelson Thacker. So, David Nelson Thacker, being the bastard that he is, went hunting for Doug, Big Dumb Doug, and I mean hunting. I believe he had someone in the car with him when he went looking for Big Dumb Doug. He took his gun. It was loaded. They see Doug walking across a parking lot. David Thacker rolls down his window and calls Doug over. Doug bends down, leans into the car. Thacker picks up his gun, puts it right on his forehead, on Doug's forehead, and pulls the trigger. And they drive away. Doug Kohler was killed instantly. His hands were still in his front pockets as he lay in a pool of his own blood when he was discovered the next morning. I can't, even saying these words, even back in 1993, it's still shocking. It's shocking that somebody felt like they had to kill a gay man because they were gay. Oh, it gets better because this is Utah. You gotta love Utah sometimes. David Nelson Thacker was arrested in a couple of days. It didn't take long for the police to track him down. Well, the judge in the case, Judge David Young. David Nelson Thacker was ready to plead guilty to manslaughter, and it was going to carry at least 15 years. But no, David Young said, you know, David Nelson Thacker, it wasn't all your fault. It was partly Doug's fault because he was gay. So the judge reduces the charges. 6 years. Now, think about this. 6 years that David Nelson Thacker received for getting up, loading his gun, driving around Park City, finding Doug Kohler, putting a gun to his forehead, and shooting. 6 years. All because Judge David Young thought that this was just a gay thing and he didn't want to ruin David Nelson Thacker's life. I hope David Nelson Thacker's life is ruined, you piece of shit. I hope you are just miserable. Hopefully you're dead. But, I mean, of course not. You've probably had a wonderful life. And our friend, Big Dumb Doug Kohler, is lying dead in the ground. And he was a wonderful, loving man. The murder took place in 1993. The sentencing took place in 1994. We're still dealing with these issues. It is ridiculous that in the year 2018, there is still hatred against gays, against transgender, you name it. If you're not heterosexual, somebody hates you. Unbelievable. And that brings me to the new TV show called Love and Hate. And it's on ID, our favorite channel. And joining us is a very, very talented man. He is director Ben Steele. Now, he directed the film Hunted, The War Against Gays in Russia, and that got rave reviews. And Ben Steele also directed the first episode of Love and Hate, and he's here to talk about it. And I'll just turn over the microphone to Ben Steele. Go ahead, Ben.
I wanted to do a story, focusing on hate crime for a long time in America. And obviously, it's become more pertinent now. Thanks to the current administration, hate crimes are rocketing. And I wanted to cover it so it's not just a sort of random act. I'm much more interested in crimes where there's a connection between the perpetrator and the victim. And so that's what we've done in this anthology or this series. And there are going to be 3 films released across the year by ID. And this is just the first one. And as you mentioned, the storytelling is incredibly important, as well as the way it looks and the way it feels. But, there is no reporter, there is no commentary or narration telling the audience what to think. It's merely the people who are participating who are, giving us their perspective. Some of them have to be lying because they offer contradictory accounts. But we don't say who's telling the truth or who's lying. It's up to the audience to come to that conclusion. And there are revelations. There are twists. There are a series of twists, across the film. Each time one of them drops, it moves the story on massively in a way that I think if this was a scripted, drama narrative, you'd kind of be like, they're making it up now. The story can't twist again like this. But that's what's so fascinating about real life is that it's, you cannot predict what happens next. And that's why I love making documentaries. So sort of kind of keep our time, maximize our time. I'm happy to do some talking. And so you asked about the access, and that's how we won access. By being straight with people, by saying the honest truth, which is we would like to present to the audience your perspective. Other people may challenge it, but we're not coming to this with an agenda, an explicit agenda. We hope that people will be enraged and provoked, it's a call to action, but we're not telling the story, on the nose. It unfolds in a powerful way without us saying at the top. You know, so for example, this is the first, and to our knowledge, remains the only hate crime of a transgender person, you know, that's been prosecuted in America. And we don't start the film with that information.
We're talking with Ben Steele, the director of the new episode on Love and Hate, which is a new program on ID coming in February. And this story is a very shocking story. It's about Josh Vallum and his girlfriend, Mercedes Williamson. Mercedes was born Michael. Mercedes was transgender. Now get this. Mercedes was kicked out of the house at 12. She was 12 and was on her own. I was curious if Mr. Steele and his group actually was able to even reach out to any members of Mercedes' family, and if so, what did they say?
Do you know what? They chose not to to take part in the film, and that was very much their approach to Mercedes' life. They chose not to take part in Mercedes' life. So they've been consistent on that. So Mercedes was forced to move out of home at a very early age. Her father felt that her decision to be known as Mercedes and to lead a transgender life was shameful, was wrong. Her mother didn't feel able to offer her real meaningful ongoing support. So Mercedes' connection to her biological family became very slender. The family wanted Mercedes to be known in court as Michael. They rejected her decision. That said, you know, it's not my place to, and the film doesn't judge those decisions, because they're also in a horrendous position, which is that their child has been murdered. And, you know, so they deserve privacy, and I've respected their wishes to remove themselves from Mercedes' life.
To me, somebody like Josh Vallum has to have something in them that is bad already, almost like they were born with it. Because, and I don't want to give away too much of the twists and turns, but Josh does go back 1, 2, 3 times and kills her. He could have called an ambulance any of those times, and he chose not to. To me, that's just a bad seed. That guy's bad.
But of course, people commit, sadly, atrocious, brutal acts. But I don't believe that that turns those people into monsters. And I also don't believe that people who you know, that if you like, there are saints and sinners, that there are monsters and heroes. I think that is a rather simplistic perception of the world, that it's comforting because it's so straightforward. You know, just like you talked about people in the South going straight to hell, or going straight to heaven. It's a very simplistic view of, you know, the afterlife. You're either in a good place or a bad place. And I think we all have good and bad kind of in a messy, contradictory way within us. And, you know, clearly what Josh did is a heinous and awful crime, but I think it's more... I'm sure, you know, having watched the film and having experienced the emotional roller coaster ride of traveling a distance with him, that you can, whilst you can be disgusted by the outcome, you can also, to a certain extent, understand how he came to be in that place.
Absolutely.
He is a product of his choices that he makes, but he's also a product of his environment. And that, you know, in many ways, this is an act of self-hate as well as an act of violence against Mercedes. It's an act of violence against himself.
I agree with everything that you say. Josh was a product of his upbringing. I believe his mother even said something like, he blacked out when he felt a penis. He didn't know what he was doing, and she's denying that Josh is gay, and, boy, Boy, it's a lot of denial down there. I'm talking about a small town in Alabama. How were you treated when you went down there? Did Josh's friends come out and speak freely? Tell us how that went for you.
Well, I was, you know, I was treated with hospitality and with, you know, people were very dignified. But, you know, I think it would be fair to say that a lot of the people that I met have, you know, if you're being charitable, you'd call them old-fashioned views. You know, in the South and across large areas of America, you know, you mentioned, for example, Utah. I think people feel that transgender individuals and the transgender community don't really deserve the same rights as others. And the police, when they initially reported this crime, didn't divulge any information about the fact that this was the body of a transgender teen. Instead, it was simply stated that it was the body of a male that had been found. And I think that part of that was to have an easy life. Part of that was police procedure. And part of that was just a sort of societal uncomfortableness with the reality of the transgender community. You know, we're seeing President Trump reignite the culture wars across America. We're seeing that issues about LGBTQ matters are being reignited in his questioning of the rights that the LGBT community should have. And he's doing it with other issues too. For example, you know, abortion rights, whether or not women have the right to choose for themselves, or whether or not that's something which, judges should be able to decide, many of whom are male.
We're talking with Ben Steele. He is a director of a new show coming on ID. It's called Love and Hate. The first episode deals with a love story gone horribly wrong. It's the story of Josh Vallum and his girlfriend, Mercedes Williamson. Mercedes was born Michael. And Josh claims that he had, quote, penis panic, unquote, when he felt the penis that Mercedes had. And that's how he ended up killing her. He blacked out and ended up killing her. Come on. And the one thing that Josh is adamant about, just absolutely adamant about, that he is not gay. But Mr. Steele, don't you think Josh is gay?
Well, I actually think the audience are going to have to come to their own conclusion on this. I'm not going to tell people what to think. I let the film speak for itself. And I think that Josh has an argument for everything. And some people find him quite convincing and believe him. And others think the evidence is very much stacked against him. And the people who are pointing out the evidence against him, and I'm stumbling there because I don't want to reveal some of the things that are uncovered in the film, but you know, they have a different point of view, and I'm going to let each individual who watches the film come to their own decisions.
Got it. Now here's something interesting. Again, don't want to give away too much, but Josh does plead guilty, and I believe Mercedes' body was found right on the border of Mississippi, so the trial would have taken place in Mississippi. And he was pretty much assured, at the very least, a hung jury if he did the penis panic defense. In that part of the country, that would have worked. Maybe even gotten off scot-free. But he refused to go to trial. He refused his one chance at freedom. Why? What do you think of that, Mr. Steele?
Well, I feel that in many ways this was a crime of violence against Mercedes, obviously, but it was also a crime of violence against himself. I feel Josh, it's about his values. What is the most important thing in his life? Is it not to commit murder? Is it to keep his liberty? Or is it to protect a secret? And if it's to protect a secret, if he believes that by pleading guilty, he can somehow control what information gets out, then perhaps in his logic, that's the right thing to do.
And on that note, Mr. Ben Steele had to take off. He was late for another appointment. You know how those people in Hollywood are. Actually, he's not one of those Hollywood guys. He's a down-to-earth, incredible director, and you have got to see this show on ID. It'll come on sometime in February. It's called Love and Hate. The first story, Josh and Mercedes, and it will blow your mind at the twists and turns of this show, I'm telling you. And we're a jaded bunch, right? We've seen it all. This one will get to you. Okay, well, that's it. Another edition of Web Sleuths Radio for you. Next week, oh, wait until next week. Unfreaking believable. Who am I going to have on? Oh, I don't know. But I'm telling you, it'll be good, okay? Next Sunday night, just look for another edition of the podcast Web Sleuths Radio. Why do we call it Web Sleuths Radio? Because when I started out, I don't think they invented the word podcast yet. So, again, proves how old I am. And remember, stay out of trouble. The last thing I want to do is have you in one of my stories. Unless you do something good. Okay? See you next week. Bye-bye.